Okay, just about made it, all being well. And you could say many people in the 1950s just about made it, and the 1960s, particularly if they were migrating. Because the key thing that we're going to look at today is, again, fundamental to not only the civil rights movement in America, but also, as far as modern Britain is concerned, how we've kind of come to be the multicultural, multidimensional world in which we currently exist. Or maybe we already have been, after a fashion. I spent a couple of the early sessions on this module talking about the dismantling of the British Empire, how post-World War II, Britain was in a situation where primarily we had two choices. We could have either fought to keep the empire together, or if we love somebody, let them free. And in essence, that was the line that was probably taken in terms of where things were going. And probably from a pragmatic point of view, it was really the most sensible political choice at the time. But the major question would possibly be, what impact did this have on the ordinary people of Britain? Did they really mind? What was their interest in terms of seeing former colonies effectively declare independence and actually secede from the British Empire? Well, an opinion poll of 1947 found that a half of those who were actually questioned couldn't actually name a single British colony in the world. One person actually suggested British colony, yes, Lincolnshire. So, admittedly, that's quite a significant number. 50% of those questioned actually didn't even have a clue about the British Empire in any way, shape or form, which maybe sets a lie to the notion of suddenly everybody is imbued with this sense of Britishness. And actually, at first, that collapse of the empire really had no real impact for the ordinary person. It didn't affect them directly. Increasing prosperity, despite rationing, despite areas like that, did tend to fuel an affluent counterculture, as we've seen in terms of the work of the art schools, the poets and so on. And actually, overall, despite one or two glitches like Suez and Korea and some of the aspects of the Cold War, overall, everything was going pretty well by most historical accounts. Nevertheless, there was still this shadow, this sense that actually Britain as a whole was seeking a new identity, a new place in the world. And the collapse of empire did actually bring one thing that people did actually react to. They might not actually care about politics or the economics of the world stage, but any sense of threats to their own community values, their jobs, housing, and their own culture inevitably provoked a reaction, often stoked by the popular press as well. And as the political links with distant races collapsed, some of the representatives of those distant nations actually were finding their own challenges. They still thought that actually Britain was the heart of their empire. And actually they didn't want to effectively be separate from the empire. They wanted to actually move to the empire and return to that one flag, one empire image. I mean, here we have a couple of slides from the early part of the 20th century. Obviously, the notion of Queen Victoria, painting cooking stoves, this sense that there was a family, the sort of rhetoric we get these days in terms of the Commonwealth and so on. And certainly during the 1950s and 1960s, there were very few subjects as controversial as the I word, immigration. In other words, migrants moving into the country. And what we'll look at over the next 30 or 40 minutes is primarily what some of the reasons for those migrations were and how they tended to sort of challenge the status quo of the British culture at the time, and arguably still do. Workers and their families throughout the 50s and 60s began to arrive in Britain in large numbers from countries such as the West Indies, South Asia, and East Africa. And what was the motivation? Well, it was seeking a better life. It was also seeking an improvement on their own particular cultures, but inevitably it was designed to leave an indelible mark on British culture. Britishness had always been about racial inheritance. Admittedly, the only major invasion that we'd ever had was from the Normans back in 1066. But overall, there was a sense that Britain over the centuries had been a melting pot. Not as much as a melting pot as the United States, and not in so short a time, but there were cultural areas and differences that occurred. As indeed, if you cast your mind back, those of you who did reporting continuity and change knew that in the latter part of the Victorian era, there was increased migration, increased immigration. As you'd expect, successful countries will attract more migrants than unsuccessful ones. Human beings want to go to where prosperity is more likely to succeed than basically staying in an area where they'll feel as though there's no place for them. There'd always been immigrants who effectively would challenge British ideas. Europeans, Irish immigrants, Jews escaping persecution. There's a large number of Jews pre-World War II who effectively migrated from Germany to again escape the atrocities of the Nazi reign. Indians, Chinese, black communities would also build up in very port areas. So cities such as Bristol, Cardiff, London, obviously, had a fair share of sailors, students, musicians, and people who were setting up restaurants. In fact, by 1900, Britain was unassailably multiracial. And unfortunately, there was already some racism that was actually present. Children would shout at black people to wash their faces. Suspicious neighbours would be very concerned. There wasn't a great deal of social mobility between the races based primarily on skin colour and so on. But, flip side of it is, we wouldn't have had an empire if British people themselves hadn't emigrated. In other words, left the country. In fact, from the Victorian period, 1900, to the end of the 20th century, more British folk left Britain than foreigners arrived. At first, that was to serve in the empire, but later people would head off to find their own better lives in countries like North America, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Africa. In other words, somewhere that was more prosperous, less gloomy, and actually gave the sense of improvement and so on. And many of these people who actually left the country were often well-educated, and it led to a panic, as the papers at the time thought, were suffering a brain drain. What happens in this room? All of the investment that's being made in your education, and you might end up working overseas. We've lost your skills and abilities and so on. You've moved from that particular map of the British Empire to the far-flung reaches of the world, and so on. So there's concern not only about people leaving the country, but also who's going to actually replace them, what's going to happen to this little part of the globe tucked in there, which we refer to as Britain. Well, there were a number of countries which had served the British Empire in the Second World War. Troops had actually been put up from, obviously, the need to pull in people from all over the British Empire just to support the world with a war effort, from New Zealand, from Australia, from India, the Gurkhas, of course, being a classic example, the Asian sort of input that's sort of coming through in terms of that. And something we'll be referring to later on in the session today is the phenomenon of the arrival on the 22nd of June 1948 of the SS Empire Windrush. It arrived at Tilbury Dock with 500 Caribbean migrants. It's very much seen as a beginning of a watershed moment and something which really created a coalescence of the press to actually look at and analyse and raise the sort of issues here. Now, 500 Caribbean migrants is not a large number. It's a trickle of migrants compared with the 75,000 black and Asian community people who were already living in Britain. You know, so Britain at this time wasn't just a case of an all-white country. There were 75,000 black and Asians already living within the whole sequence. However, it differed insofar as it was a much photographed press element. It was seen as an odd event. It also became an iconic foreshadowing of things to come. You know, suddenly you get a gradual movement and an increase in terms of migrants. Now, these people on the Windrush had paid £28.10. So basically the equivalent, I suppose, of maybe £1,000 in contemporary sort of money, to visit what they saw as the mother country. If you have that image of basically an empire which is very benevolent, which is very prosperous, which manages things effectively, which has brought such wonderful things as afternoon tea and culture such as that to an area which previously might have actually seen sooty as a perfectly capable way of actually ensuring that when your husband dies as the widow, you also have to be thrown onto the funeral pyre as well. Lots of cultural differences, lots of aspects that come across in all sorts of areas. You may well think that actually, why would you want to go it alone? It's a bit like the Scottish situation at present. Do you go with Nicola Sturgeon, or do you actually step away? I mean, if you actually picture at the moment a kind of cartoon where Prime Minister Theresa May is wearing a captain's hat and a lifeboat, pointing a gun at anybody who wants to jump out of the lifeboat, you might get a sense of where things are going. Just a thought. But in terms of that whole sequence, as I say, these 500 people, most of them had paid £28.10. 18 of those hadn't actually raised the money and had stowed away, so they were stowaways. And inevitably they turn up and they were fed and housed in shelters and they were taken to the British Labour Exchange to find work. Now, as I say, the Windrush effectively kind of arrived, it kind of landed, not like an alien invasion, but it just sort of, it appeared, you know, people who basically wanted to come to Britain and they used the Windrush, the Empire Windrush, to actually travel here. And it surprised a number of folk. The government actually debated at the time, this was a Labour government, about sending them on to Kenya. But in the end, because of political situations, they thought, well, best not cause embarrassment, let's make them welcome, because after all, these people are British subjects. They are subjects of the Empire. The Caribbean is still part of the Empire, and the fact that they just want to visit us. You know, just imagine suddenly you get 500 people turning up on your doorstep and think, oh, what are we going to do? How are we going to cope with this? And so on. Okay, first step. Within a few months, other ships began to arrive. Why? Well, number one, unemployment was high in the Caribbean. In addition to that, we can thank the Americans. Yay! Because the Americans, under the United States of America, were bringing in laws which stopped seasonal work in Florida. Okay? All the southern states effectively lost their call on migrant workers that clearly had been a major source of employment for people working in the Caribbean. So what did they actually do when the nearest country to them, America, effectively said, sorry, we're going to build a metaphorical wall? Ooh, where have we heard that before? Inevitably, we get to this situation whereby the young people were thinking, okay, let's get out of here. Let's emigrate. And if you can't emigrate to America, let's go to the mother country. Let's return, or let's go to Britain. Because there is this great image. And to be fair, during the Second World War, we were extremely grateful. There's lots of wonderful texts. Andrew Levy wrote a wonderful book called Small Island. Really outlines the differences and experience of a chap who fought for the Caribbean in British Army, did, you're really grateful, etc., lots of positive things, and then suddenly things change, okay? Things get sort of adjusted. But there's still this notion that, well, actually Britain's better than staying here. And by the period 1958 to 1962, immigration actually had become a major issue. There were tens of thousands of folk who arrived from the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinents who effectively were all trying to beat the immigration of British controls, because even then, of course, there's the demand for something to be done. Even though, as we'll see, within the 50s, there is also a big propaganda campaign to encourage people to migrate to Britain. Because we, in Britain, require people to staff health services, drive buses, do various other sort of tasks and so on, and there's problems and challenges with respect to that. But let's look at some of the numbers that came through. In 1953, there were 3,000 migrants. In 1956, there were 30,000 migrants. In 1961, 66,000. Now again, in the great scheme of things, you're basically talking about a little under two-thirds of Wembley Stadium. It's not a huge amount. Clearly, in terms of an aggregate scenario, you might sort of think of there are problems within that. And there are thousands of people from the West Indies who, as I've already said, had already been to Britain because they'd served in the Second World War as part of the British Army. And they'd received training, they'd received pay, they'd received lodgings. Generally, it was a case of many people were sorry to see them go, or claimed they were sorry to see them go, and so they thought, well, we're going to be welcome here. In addition to that, the British economy needed cheap labour. It needed cheap labour because the economy was booming. Why was it booming? Well, think back to Lecture 1. Big housing scenario. Lots of roads being built. Lots of building programmes being put together and structured and rebuilt from that point of view. But they don't just magically go up. You need to have people to be navvies on roads, to effectively build the things, to structure the things, and so on. So, what better way, from a governmental point of view, when you've got a booming economy, you've got severe labour shortages, than to actually encourage people to migrate to you? And the British Nationality Act of 1948 meant that all subjects of the Crown, in whichever country you were, if you were a subject of the British Empire, you were entitled to citizenship, which meant the payoff, an endless supply of what was seen as cheap labour to actually work in a whole variety of industries. Great! This is a win-win situation. Let's move into a whole sort of range of things and open up and develop, you know, our own sort of input. In 1956, London Transport loaned money for thousands of people to emigrate from Barbados to fill vacancies. Other schemes were run by British Rail, by the NHS, by the hotel industry. So there's a big demand to actually say, come to Britain, all will be well, all will be fantastic, and so on. By 1961, the black and Asian population was up, as I said, to 337,000. But we then had a situation where unemployment started to bite, the other end of the coin. And there was also a growing agitation against immigration. There are, regrettably, and were, hopefully fewer still, people who get very, very concerned on the difference of somebody who happens to have a different skin colour / culture, seen very much as a threat. And there are lots of tales where, effectively, you will see no coloured sign, no coloured people that need apply, etc. There was certainly a very explicit racist element in parts of Britain within the 1950s. If you want to see, again, a fictional account of that, read some of the work of Colin McInnes. Certainly his Absolute Beginners novel, again, addresses the issues with respect to that. The other thing with introducing legislation that's going to actually limit immigration into the country, and that's the Commonwealth Immigrants Act of 1962, in which immigration was limited to skilled workers, meant that suddenly people want to get in to beat the final sort of bureaucratic portcullis which is about to descend. And so there was a huge rush at the start of the 1960s, which meant that more people arrived in 18 months than in the previous 5 years put together, which led to another 150,000. So numbers are actually going up quite significantly. And after the Commonwealth Immigrants Act of 1962, migration still continued, but mostly these were skilled workers and also dependents of the original migrants, so possibly family members, wives, children, and so on. Now, inevitably, people who arrived would have their own identity, and they'd also have their own potential rivalries. They are human beings. We are not getting a homogenous group where you can turn around and say, oh yes, you're from the West Indies, you've all got that. You know, that's why we're into stereotypes and so on. Christians and Rastafarians have fundamentally different outlooks on life. India and Pakistan are competing states. They've got different religious majorities. And people from different islands have different cultures and different outlooks. And inevitably, once they become part of a country, populations will grow. And the first generation will also be setting up homes and starting families. During the 1950s, the focus of migration had shifted north. Okay? It moved into the industrial centres. Why? Because work was available. Work was available in the manufacturing industries, the heavy industries that we've actually got here. You know, one of the lines, Birmingham, Wolverhampton, and so on, referred to as the Black Country, it's very much an industrial heartland of the whole sequence. You know, it needs people to actually do the hard production, manufacturing-based scenario. And new communities would spring up in the West Midlands, and they'd spring up in Lancashire. Immigrants would take the unpopular night shift jobs, or they'd work as porters and cleaners in the ever-expanding National Health Service. And from the very beginning, the immigrants were offered low-paid jobs in defining areas, and also declining areas. Areas that became defined by the fact that they were not necessarily the best areas to actually sort of be established in. And because you've only got low pay for your job, you could only afford cheap housing. So you've got a vicious cycle. Low pay, cheap housing leads to a lot of people settling in areas where crime rates are high, and you also get anxiousness amongst the white inhabitants about failing communities and unemployment. This is the period, as I say, where also you're getting large areas of the country being effectively cleared, slum demolish, slum clearance, rebuilding, repackaging after the war, and so on. So inevitably, it's natural that migrants will stick together in a fairly hostile new environment, strength in numbers. Almost a kind of ghettoisation is occurring. As the immigrants will build their own networks, they'll build their own communities. And so you see this kind of demographic appearing if you look at the statistics of the time and, you know, currently. Jamaicans would predominantly live in Clapham, in Brixton. Trinidadians from Trinidad, people would settle in Notting Hill. Moss Side in Manchester became seen as a black belt. Likewise, Nicholson Street in Glasgow became Burma Road, because of its Indian and Pakistani settlers. Also, what you see happening within that whole area is a whole range of intrinsic shops developing and working through their own cultures, their own restaurants, their own cinemas, their own coffee bars. Now, okay, what's the problem? Well, if you are somebody who's grown up, been born and bred in a particular part of the country, be it London, Manchester, Glasgow, Newcastle, Wolverhampton, whatever, and you've been used to the sense of British folk, white folk, predominantly, this whole notion of something which is seen as strange, the making strange, different signs, different cultures. You see the sort of situation here replicated, arguably, with Polish occupation, Boston, and so on. Again, there's this strangeness. This is not us. This is you know, something to be concerned. As I've said, Britain, as an ex-imperial trading nation, had always imported culture. It had imported spices from India and porcelain from China and everything in between. But what you get in a 15-year period is a real explosion in the 1950s and 1960s of foreign food. As Britons became affluent and began to eat out, the first food outlets which actually benefited were the Chinese and Indian ones. The first London Chinese takeaway actually opened in 1958, and the proprietor, John Coon, K-O-O-N, persuaded Butlins to add chop suey and chips to their menu. And by the end of the 1960s, the takeaway foodstuff was very much mass market. Certainly a significant change from, if you want to take away food, there was a fish and chips shop, and that was basically it. Indian restaurants also took off in a big way. There were a few hundred Indian restaurants in the country in 1960. By the 1990s, there were over 10,000 Indian restaurants, major growth area. Again, British people had been cooking their own Indian food since the 1800s. And there were hybrid recipes that they actually used, which were unknown in India. But the Indian community also quickly learned to produce those hybrid recipes, such as chicken tikka masala and so on. And other areas became an intrinsic part of culture and so on. Now, most immigrants had never actually seen themselves as defined by their own colour. Why would you? Racism inevitably was clearly a source of unhappiness. Simply being picked upon because of the colour of your skin. Whoa, what is that? Where are we going with respect to this whole area? Most of the immigrants would come from rural economies, but they were forced to settle in what to them were bewildering urban landscapes. You know, suddenly you're plonked from what might have been a very rural farming basis in, say, the West Indies, and then you end up in the middle of Wolverhampton. It's a bit of a culture shock. 50% of migrants were also forced to settle for jobs that actually didn't make use of their skills. And regularly one hears various anecdotal tales about customs inspectors who had to settle for cleaning jobs, barristers who were fully trained in the law who had to become bus conductors. Primarily because it was seen that their degrees and their qualifications were useless in this new homeland. Some immigrants were clearly not ready for the isolation and loneliness of this life. Others managed to settle in. But fundamentally, and rather unfortunately, racial stereotyping continues to prove to be central to the British outlook. Together with, most regrettably, theories and feelings of white superiority, and this whole notion that one of the aspects of the British Empire was to civilise inferior races. Now, as I say, there are cultural shifts, cultural differences, but to simply assume that you are superior on the basis of skin colour is surely the most craziest logic of all. Britain, on the other hand, did have a reputation for unique tolerance. We did not set up the equivalent of the American, white American Ku Klux Klan and effectively have cookout parties where black slaves would be regularly, effectively hung, drawn and quartered. But at the same time, the welcome received by migrants, by ordinary folk, was often unhelpful. And many boarding houses, many hotels, many dance halls, many bars would operate what was referred to as a discreet colour bar. It wasn't so much that there was an explicit bar on people of a different skin colour coming in, but you wouldn't be let through the door. British people also continued to be very ignorant about where the migrants came from and their culture and religion. For example, many Jamaicans were commonly confused with Africans, and they were stereotyped as violent, childlike, lazy, primitive, and not even able to speak English properly. People would worry about intermarriage. They'd worry about drugs. They'd worry about differing lifestyles. But particularly there was a sense in the press at the time, you can look at letters, of areas relating to housing. Cheap housing, despite the huge building projects that were going on, was in short supply, and migrants were commonly overcharged for it. Even if they actually found one of the 15 landlords in every thousand, just say that again, 15 landlords in every thousand who actually said that they would rent property to black people. Most migrants did manage to find somewhere to live, but they squeezed into overcrowded houses, or they bought up houses that several families could live in. But again, the arrival of black neighbours posed a threat to property prices. And this phenomenon of what we refer to as white flight from the streets with migrant neighbours only helped to confine the new communities, keep them in ghettos, and frighten the old ones. So you've got a situation here underpinning all of the rest of the society, which is actually full of frustration, full of unhappiness. In May 1948, there was a crowd of 250 young men who stoned a house in Birmingham housing Indians. In July 1949, 1,000 white men besieged a group of blacks in a hostel for several nights. And in 1956, there were two houses in Camden set on fire by whites, trying to force the Caribbean folk out. Again, competition for housing was rife during this period. One landlord, Peter Rachman, who himself was actually a Polish refugee, became notorious for his activities. Rachman spelled R-A-C-H-M-A-N. And Rachman would evict long-term tenants on protected rents. And it wasn't just a case of a straight eviction. Rachman would actually send in gangs of thugs who would make the flats uninhabitable and start threatening people. He would then let out rooms at a huge profit to new black immigrants. Most of his houses were actually scarcely fit for human inhabitants. One of Rackman's houses, a standard, I suppose, two up, two down, you describe it as, had 11 inhabitants, one filthy toilet, one cold tap in the backyard. It was infested with rats, and the walls were full of insects. However, one black tenant did actually defend Peter Rackman in court and said that at least he would let to blacks, which was more than most would. The most violent racist incident of this particular period took place in 1958, both in Nottingham and in London. On the 23rd of August 1958, in a rundown area of St. Anne's, where 2,000 West Indians were already afraid to go out because of white men going, apologies for the term here, nigger hunting, there was a fight that broke out in a pub. Seven whites ended up in hospital and a policeman was run over. The news spread of that incident, and a mob of over 1,000 white men and women assembled with razors, bottles and knives, simply looking for West Indians. Eight more were injured, and then it actually petered out from the point of view of St. Anne's area in Nottingham. Yes. Sorry. Oh, I thought you were... comment there. Sorry. The troubles continued in Notting Hill in London, probably fuelled by media reports. Something which wasn't too dissimilar to kind of challenge we had in 2011 here, although that was a slightly different issue, again, in the sort of pre-Olympic area. Notting Hill in London, again, in the 50s, was a slum area. It was overcrowded. It was full of terrible living conditions. Again, shared bathrooms, crime, gang battles, prostitution. Not a pleasant place. And on the 24th of August, Sunday, police stopped several cars full of white men who were heading to West London simply to actually beat up some black people. One contained nine hunters, so to speak, aged between 17 and 20, who carried a knife, table legs and so on. And they'd already attacked five Caribbean people in Shepherd's Bush, so they'd obviously warmed up from that routine, as well as Ladbroke Grove as well. The following bank holiday weekend, crowds of whites turned out in Notting Hill, attacking homes with bricks, even petrol bombs and so on. Most of these folk were young, white, working-class males out to cause trouble. However, unlike the kind of mods and rockers battles that we'd seen and the elements within that, underpinning this thing was many of the white residents of Notting Hill and so on would actually cheer on these young, brave folk, basically with the older men singing racist songs and chanting, "Keep Britain White." By the Monday and Tuesday, there were thousands of people who were hurling bottles and petrol bombs. It's astonishing that in terms of 1958's Notting Hill race riots, there wasn't a single fatality. I think, you know, again, at least there was something that was looking after folk on that basis. Inevitably, though, the press would take on the teenage delinquent approach. And as we've already seen in terms of youth culture and so on, the youth of the day had too much money, they didn't have any morals, they were made scapegoats, they were full of hooligans and the aforementioned teddy boys and so on. The Daily Mirror actually showed a cartoon of Hitler egging on a teddy boy, although actually there were very few teddy boys left by 1958. Fundamentally, these are all symptoms that are raised, and you can look back in press areas and see what's provided, but they're not the cause. And no one was really discussing racism or, indeed, the culture of the working class as being a fundamental cause of these race riots. Yes, it's clear that too many migrants were settling in areas that actually couldn't assimilate them. It was too much too soon. And as a result, in 1959, 4,500 migrants said, "We've had enough, we're leaving." They went home. Those who actually remained seems to feel a stronger sense of unity. There was a determination to find a place for themselves in British society. We look in seminars at some of the kind of culturally accepted popular issues that we use to show black people in the media and so on, including a show which was highly popular in its day, again, strictly of its time, called The Black and White Minstrel Show, which featured white singers blacked up, like Al Jolson, as black Caribbean singers and so on. What were they thinking? Well, perhaps they weren't thinking at all. In 1961, a poll showed that 67% of people wanted immigration restricted. And as I've already mentioned, the Commonwealth Immigrants Bill of 1962 did exactly that. In the early 1960s, the bohemian set, i.e. the artists and the former art college graduates, etc., also descended on Notting Hill. It's undergoing what we refer to really as a period of gentrification and becoming a kind of more acceptable area to live in. And indeed, the Notting Hill Carnival on an annual basis is one of the things which emerges out of the kind of challenges that Notting Hill was faced with. Part of this was, again, arguably due to American influence, the notion of the beatniks and the poets in America who would be getting fashionably involved in black culture and music, jazz, ska, blue beat, all becoming trendy issues, as indeed were drugs. But again, you can argue that that's very patronising. It actually starts stereotyping black culture as having to do with loud music, sex and drugs. There also seemed to be a lot of confusion which arose from the impact of African-American culture. Some whites moved into the Notting Hill area, suffering from what at the time was referred to as the white nigger syndrome. In other words, they were feeling guilty and they felt they had to undergo that whole process, which inevitably does nothing to help the black community in terms of identity, in terms of reputation, or in terms of assimilation into the wider, very conservative white society. I mentioned Colin McInnes earlier, and again, he's possibly the most successful writer who covers this period in books like City of Spades and Absolute Beginners. McInnes imagines a fusion of black and white teenagers that will create a better society. Unfortunately, McInnes himself wasn't an expert on teenagers or indeed black culture. In fact, he's generally regarded as more of a disaffected upper-class homosexual. His books do pull up all the old stereotypes in which the blacks are shown as noble savages who could pump energy and innocence into tired and cynical white society. So again, this whole notion of stereotypes and archetypes and aspects that are developed begin to manifest itself. Others would view immigrants as teenagers, as coffee bars, drugs, all of these sort of things, you know, symptoms of a society that's suffering from moral and cultural decline. It wasn't like that back in my day. And meanwhile, the black community actually had to deal with the realities of immigration, realities such as prejudice, hard working conditions, cramped living conditions, and grey and cold cities. By 1968, the argument over immigration was being redefined. Again, 68, particularly key year that we're coming to here. Not only are we seeing, as we'll see in a few weeks' time, the Parisian riots, we're getting the revolutionary riots, we're getting a whole range of other elements coming through on that basis globally, and of course we're at the height of the Vietnam War. Opponents of immigration thought that the changing ethnic composition of the country was part of a more general crisis which threatened social stability. And the most forceful advocate, gentleman you can see up there, Conservative MP Enoch Powell, made a shattering speech in 1968, which is often called the Rivers of Blood speech. Interesting, insofar as Powell had been one of the key folk who was responsible for inviting and setting up things, inviting migrants to come to Britain to support the NHS and so on. But he felt there were too many. You can see, again, a sort of image there in terms of the irony that we get in terms of Enoch Powell, who was touted very much as a conservative political leader at the time. There was lots of research into ethnic communities which showed that, yes, they, non-white people, were being discriminated against in terms of housing and jobs. And the government plans to extend the 1965 Race Relations Act with additional anti-discriminatory legislation. But then, just when we thought, oh, it's okay, we're going to sort things out, 1968, Kenya occurs. Now, Kenya, African country, had been granted independence of Britain in 1963. Then, in 1967, the Kenyan government embarked on a process and a policy of Africanization. Whites and Indian non-nationals were being pushed out of their jobs. But they'd also been told, well, you're not allowed to work in Kenya, but why don't you bugger off to Britain? And thousands of Kenyan Asians effectively packed up and came during the period 1967 to 1968. So these were people who were not authentic Kenyan African people. They were Indian, Asian non-nationals, people who might have migrated there from one part of the empire into another empire. Suddenly they're faced with, where do we actually go? Well, let's go to Britain. And thousands of Kenyan Asians packed up, left the country, and came during the period 1967 to 1968. Inevitably, Conservative MPs Enoch Powell and Duncan Sandys, S-A-N-D-Y-S, led a campaign to restrict their entry, which was also backed by the then leader of the opposition, Edward Heath. And an emergency bill was pushed through that effectively allowed whites who were British by descent, but everyone else who wanted to come to Britain from Kenya, if you weren't white, effectively you'd have to have a voucher scheme, which meant you could have the voucher if you could actually put together at least £1,500 per annum to actually have the privilege of seeking work in Britain. So again, an interesting kind of system there in terms of a concern that, well, if you let all these people in, the island's going to sink, and so on. And on the 20th of April 1968, in Birmingham, Enoch Powell made his famous speech about limiting immigration. "We must be mad," he said, literally, "mad as a nation, calling for a halt to non-white immigration and a voluntary repatriation program." So that was clearly what his line was. That was his focus. You know, he didn't want to get to this stage. He'd already, and if you're looking for motivations, you'd say, okay, Powell had seen what had happened in Notting Hill. He'd seen the potential powder keg of race challenges. He'd also seen quite explicitly lots of race riots and issues in America through the medium of television and so on, and felt we didn't want to risk a similar thing occurring in Britain. So he comes out with this line of saying, too much, enough is enough. And inevitably, you get this polarity, this binary opposition that you see represented in the two slides there. On the one hand, it is racist, it's not borderline racist. Stop immigration, Enoch is right. The white child there holding up her Union Jack in one hand. And what about our future? The rhetoric is actually there. And the flip side of it is, obviously, another character effectively there with the V sign up Enoch Powell in terms of the line from there. Inevitably, you start pressing that race riot button, that immigrant button, really getting on to the fears, the fear factor that people get concerned about. We've seen elections run on a similar sort of a platform as well. You've got a whole range of issues. You've got a very inflammatory tone. Powell talked about white constituents in Birmingham who were scared to go out of their houses. That actually, it wasn't just white prejudice against blacks, it was also black prejudice against whites. And that there was antisocial behaviour taking place that was directed specifically at whites. Again, as we see here, another sort of balance in terms of the protest and the lines that are Adolf Heath enough, as in Ted Heath. Black Panther movement, which was obviously a major story in America at the time, looking for not just black activist movements and so on, fights for justice for all black people, and obviously Indian students shocked by a colour bill and so on. But even for Edward Heath, later Prime Minister Heath, this was actually too much in terms of Powell's views and lines with respect to this perspective on limiting immigration and so on. And Edward Heath sacked him from the shadow cabinet the following day. However, as we've seen in the slides so far, and you can go back and find evidence of this, even now people say, Enoch Powell, he was right all along. Many folk actually regarded him as the champion of the silent majority. I once actually had a colleague who worked in broadcasting for BBC Leeds who had an interview with Enoch Powell in the latter end of his life. He was very sharp. He was a very sharp political individual. He was actually asked by a chap, Mr. Powell, some people think you're a racist. To which Enoch said, do they? Name one. And the moral of that story is make sure you've checked your facts out and actually name names, because the interviewee sort of the interviewer collapsed a little bit after that, really. Sort of by the by. But nevertheless, if we look at polls of the time, something between 67% and 82% of those questioned actually approved of Enoch Powell's speech. Many feared the loss of British culture. They feared this loss of traditions. And inevitably, the scapegoats would not only be the youth, i.e. the people who don't understand what we fought for, but also the black community. And if you happen to be young and black, disaster. Whilst the hippies would romanticise and fantasise their caricature of black country, black culture, in the words of writer Dominic Sandbrook, prejudice remained a normal feature of British society. The Race Relations Act of 1968 banned discrimination, overt discrimination, and the 1971 Immigration Act effectively halted large-scale immigration from the old colonies. But old attitudes continued to surface from time to time. And again, even in our contemporary culture, I think we still have a challenge with respect to battle against the spectre of racism and so on. We'll go on to consider, in terms of seminars, some of the mass media's approach to that and how, even though the Natty Hill riot of colour and image, etc., presents a slightly different viewpoint half a century on from the Notting Hill riots, there's still quite a way to go on the journey. Thanks for your time. Make sure you've signed the register, and I'll see some of you in seminars.